Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, one thing you can say about the way we live today is that we have great enthusiasm for things that are new. And in part, as a result, there are some buildings that end up being torn down for no other reason than their age. Now, it certainly is true that older structures can pose a lot of challenges, but saving historic buildings can do a lot of things for the community. It certainly can help maintain the character of the community. It's a kind of education because it shows you something of the way people lived in past generations. It also can preserve the workmanship that you find in many older buildings. And some people, in fact, would argue that there's an ecological dimension here because reusing an existing structure is a kind of recycling on a very grand scale. If you can find building and reuse it and perhaps find a new use for an older existing structure. In this part of Focus 580, we'll talk a little bit about saving old buildings. And our guest is Mike Jackson. He is the chief architect of the Preservation Services Division of the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. And he directs the agency's architectural staff in evaluating changes to historic buildings when those alterations fall under a variety of regulatory and benefit programs. He's been with the agency since 1983. He was project manager for the restoration of the Dana Thomas House in Springfield and also the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington. He supervises the agency's design services provided to the Illinois Main Street program. He has degrees from the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign and also Columbia University. He's a fellow of the American Institute of Architects, and his professional experience includes work in New York City and also New Orleans, as well as communities across the state of Illinois. He is a visiting professor of architecture at the U of I in Urbana-Champaign. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, and we do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. At any point, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask callers to try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep our program moving, but anybody who's listening is welcome to call in. Mr. Jackson, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, that's right.
Is it true? I sort of have this impression. Now there may be a lot of reasons why an existing structure is torn down, and there may, in fact, be good reasons for the fact that it might be torn down. But I guess I am interested in whether it really is true that buildings end up being demolished that could be reused and that they're torn down simply just because someone says, well, that building is old. Let's get rid of that and put up something new.
Well, I think this brings up a whole cultural question, you know, which is why do we, you know, replace things? Why do we throw things away? And clearly we are in a consumer culture where we're constantly bombarded by messages of, you know, this is the newest version, get rid of that. And in the preservation industry, you know, our cultural message, I think, is that there are things we value of what we have from a cultural meaning and other reasons, and therefore they're valid to continue using them. And in our term of art, we've kind of evolved something that we call historic rehabilitations, as opposed to restorations, where you're going to visit a building so that you've experienced it of the past. This idea of an historic rehabilitation is really the idea of making buildings work for contemporary uses, continuously investing in them, but doing so in a manner that respects what are the, say, architectural and culturally significant aspects of the building. Mm-hmm. And right now, that's going on campus with Lincoln Hall. Lincoln Hall's going through an historic rehabilitation project. It's not going to be, when it's done, it's going to still look like it does now on the outside and the big main entrance marble staircase when you go in and the auditorium. But the office spaces and the classroom spaces will be reconfigured quite a bit for contemporary uses. And that's kind of the thing we get into a lot, is finding that right balance between reusing and adapting and making it work for contemporary needs.
Well, I think this is it's interesting to make that distinction and think about that, because I expect that probably some people, when you say historic preservation, what they think of is historic structures that have been restored and preserved, and the attempt is to restore them as much as possible to their original condition and appearance. So what you end up with something is that, in effect, it's a museum. Now,
yeah,
it's not a building people are going to live in.
Sure, and that's really where preservation got its start. And in America, often it's cited as the Mount Vernon Ladies Association was the first preservation organization, and they were dedicated to saving George Washington's home. And in fact, they still own it. It's not a federal property. And that's probably where preservation was at as a cultural phenomena for about the first 100 years it was around. And then somewhere after World War II, really starting probably in the 60s, we started to evolve this idea that preservation is more than just individual isolated buildings of important people or stories, but a more collective approach to the environment. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it goes back to that start in the 20s and 30s. We were starting to see that in some distinctive places like New Orleans and Charleston, South Carolina. They both had preservation ordinances starting in the 1920s that were about a collective place. So that's kind of the big story of that. But in where this really comes in terms of communities across Illinois, it really starts here more in the 1960s. Chicago in 1958 had a preservation ordinance that was one of the first in Illinois. And then in the late 60s, we really ramped it up with the Federal Preservation Act and this collective way of communities starting to look at this as a part of where they are. Mm-hmm. And I think across the older communities in the U.S., any larger town probably has some sort of historic preservation organization in place. It's really been integrated through the planning of communities that this is something you think about if, when you think about your town, your place, what it is. And I like to pose the idea that preservationists began with looking at the past, but now we've turned ourselves into futurists because what we're really saying when we identify a place that's distinctive and has cultural value, whether it's through its architecture or connectivity, is that this is a place that deserves to stay and be a part of the future. That this building, you know, is more than just an object. It has a story to tell, and yet it has to be a useful story. And so that's where this is all coming together. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm really trying to tie this idea of preservation and green design as an idea that basically when you reuse a building, it's the best form of sustainable design. Mm-hmm. And that's a big issue that's going on in our culture. Everybody is being bombarded by this is green behavior, and our line is the greenest building is the one that already exists.
I think this, in a sense, you've already explored this, but I guess to me, one of the interesting questions, or maybe one of the questions I've raised with other people when we tried to talk about this topic, does have to do with how much of a building needs to remain before you count that preservation. That it, you know, for example, you have a structure and you say it's significant. Supposing that you just completely gut that building and all you have left is the skin, and then essentially you put a modern building inside. So from the outside, maybe it looks as much as you can like it did before, but inside everything is completely different. All the mechanical systems are different. The way the space is used is different. Do you count that as historic preservation?
Well, every time we approach a project, we're finding that where is that line at between how much of the building still has to be there to be the historic building. And our bottom line is that if you just propped up the facade of a building and that's all that was there, we don't even recognize that as being an historic building because it's not the structure, it's just the facade. And a term of art for that now is the facadectomy. Basically, you just left the facade and then a whole new structure showed up behind it. And they are going on in some urban areas, particularly where there's a higher density that's allowed. So you don't see that so much where in the lower density building types. But the issue of how much has to be preserved on the interior to still have the historic building comes up every day with our programs, not so much from local preservation programs, which generally don't review work on the interior. But for us, it really comes down to what's there when you started. If a building had very little in the way of historic features surviving because there was a fire that damaged everything, or it was remodeled in the 1960s and everything was ripped out of the inside except the basic floor structure, then a total gut rehab can be an historic rehab. So we measure every building by what you start with and try and identify what features have some historic merit to them. And it's a judgment call at each time.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, Mike Jackson. He is the chief architect of the Preservation Services Division of the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. And we're talking here about historic preservation. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about the ecological dimension of this. And I think that this is perhaps a way of thinking about preservation that is new, or at least it's new to me, the idea that by, as I said in the introduction, by doing a kind of recycling on a very large scale, you are in fact, in a sense, saving resources and energy, because resources and energy went into building that structure. So anything that you can continue to use means, I guess, that then new resources and new energy won't have to be used.
Absolutely. In fact, you brought up this idea of the energy use and evaluation, and here we have a really great story to start with, because the concept that you've brought up is embodied energy, the energy that it took to, you know, fire a brick and transport it and install it and put it in a building or make steel. And in 1976, scientists at the University of Illinois and an architect named Richard Stein together published a book called Energy Use in Building Construction, and it was the seminal work in our culture of trying to look at that exact equation. What does it take of resources, particularly energy resources, to make a building, and find a sort of a technical argument for building reuse? We are now just updating that information and starting to use it again as a ecological tool for preservation in the argument of building reuse. And that hasn't been done for a while. That 76 study kind of got out there, and just as our kind of culture as a collective kind of stopped paying attention to energy conservation in the 1980s, that idea of embodied energy research as a preservation idea kind of fell fallow, and now we're reviving it again because it starts to have a real merit to it, to show in a quantifiable way how building reuse really is good for the environment by reducing the demand for new energy, new products, new services. And the green design industry is starting to wake up to this message and trying to figure out how to fit that into the equation.
Mm-hmm. So I suppose there's in making this decision about a particular building, and if you're going to try to save it or you can try to save part of it, I'm sure there's all sorts of things that will enter into the equation, and economics have to and aesthetics have to. But does it actually come down to the kind of a thing where you can essentially, if you have the right kind of numbers and the right kind of data, you can plug it into some kind of a model and it can actually tell you whether it makes sense or not? Or is it still ultimately?
Well, I think that's what we're working towards, is that. And I bring this up because I've talked a lot about this in various formats, but I think we have a strong cultural literacy in our country about the energy performance of automobiles, because for 30-some years now, when you go buy a car, it's got a sticker that tells you what is your miles per gallon, you know, what's its efficiency. We have no similar literacy about buildings. So if you go buy a house, you might sort of learn something about are the utility bills, where they are. But, you know, most people don't have any idea when they buy a house, are they buying a Prius or a Hummer? You know, is this a house that's equal to a 50-mile-per-gallon house, or is this an 8-mile-per-gallon house? And I think our embodied energy is even another part of that aspect. You know, is this a building that has great resources that have been used that are there that now can be saved? So we're all trying to tie these numbers together, but the rule of thumb that I'm using for people is that a typical building has the energy equivalent of 5 to 15 gallons of gas per square foot. So if you own a 5,000 square foot, or let's say you own a 2,000 square foot house, you know, times 5, that has the equivalent of 10,000 gallons of gas of energy in it, which would, I hope I got that right. And that basically would be, you know, $40,000 worth of energy at $4 a gallon.
I guess I could imagine some people at least saying, if you take an older structure, maybe you've got a building that's between 50 and 100 years old, and you know that what to bring it up to contemporary standards of energy efficiency, that you're going to have to do a lot of things. You may have to put in a lot of extra insulation. You may have to look at your windows. You may have to look at roofing. And certainly you're going to look at the mechanical systems. And all of that's going to be quite expensive. And retrofitting particularly if you're trying to maintain as much as you can of the character of the building, can be difficult, that some people would still say, you know, at the end of the day, it still makes more sense for us to start from the ground up?
I would say that the popular conception of most Americans is that that's where they're heading now when they think green. Mm-hmm. Their attitude is that the old buildings are just basically going to be, you know, more expensive. That is not true for older commercial buildings. And it's basically, you know, buildings built before 1920 that are used for commercial purposes, mm-hmm. statistically have just as good an energy efficiency as new buildings. And the reasons for that is that our ancestors built very compact, multi-story buildings. In downtowns, they built buildings shoulder to shoulder so that there was no exposed sidewall. So when you look in the aggregate, the earlier commercial buildings are actually quite efficient, and we've been doing some of those energy statistics on these. The ones that are probably the least efficient, though, are buildings that have the maximum amount of surface envelope for area. So your big Queen Anne house with turrets and bay windows, and, you know, that may be the house type that has, you know, the lesser levels of efficiency because it's got a lot more envelope per square foot than, say, a tight little compact form building. There was a recent English study, and I love the title. It's called New Tricks with Old Bricks. And they basically looked at exactly the equation you're looking at. You know, if you renovate an existing old building, can it become as efficient as a new building? And take the embodied energy into the equation. And their information was that it takes 50 years for a new building to last before you've basically rebalanced the equation in favor of new construction. And they actually said that the existing buildings can be just as efficient as the new ones. And they were primarily looking at masonry buildings, as the English don't have as much of the wood frame lightweight structures as we have. But it's an interesting recent study that just came out in March. New tricks with old bricks.
Well, we have a caller here to talk with, and I'd like to invite other folks who are listening as well. If you have questions, comments, 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. And we do also have a toll-free line if you're listening around to Illinois and Indiana over the air or across the country on the Internet. Use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We have a caller over in Belgium, not too far away, line 4. Right here, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to bring up a topic that's probably just a little bit different and maybe not quite as in your area as you might want. But over here in the East Central Illinois area, it's somewhat of a blighted area. And the homes are built, especially in the Danville area, some of them are very old homes, built way back 1900, something like that. And they have since gone pretty well to seed, and they're really pretty much beyond restoration, a lot of them. But the thing I find most objectionable about is that we don't reuse the materials inside these buildings. Now, I know some people take faucet fixtures and doorknobs and architectural items off of these buildings to use, but the truly valuable gold that's inside these buildings is lumber that is of the virgin growth timber that was in the United States, especially in the Michigan area where they destroyed the pineries to build the Danville area, Chicago area, many areas that they use very, very prime lumber. And they just come in with a bulldozer and knock these buildings down, and they never even try to salvage any of this lumber. Now, I realize that salvaging this lumber is more expensive than buying new lumber in some ways, but you don't get the quality in the new lumber that you got in the old lumber. And I was wondering, do you folks ever deal in that aspect of it?
Actually, this is interesting in that in working with this information on embodied energy and building research that I've been involved with and talking about, one of the groups that has discovered me is the Building Materials Reuse Association. And I've actually will be speaking at their national conference next year. So this is another part of that aspect, I think, of our culture as a collective becoming more efficient in the use of resources is building dismantling rather than building demolition. And the Building Materials Reuse Association is an organization promoting that. And you're correct to say that the small wood frame houses are one of the harder building types to encourage this behavior at because of the labor cost per material. But You're also totally correct that the original old growth lumber that was used in a typical 2x4 in 1900 is just about better than any wood you can buy today in terms of density and quality and durability and non-reproducibility, basically. And there's no place growing that kind of wood anymore for contemporary use. I tell people we have trees grown on steroids now, and they grow puffy and fast, and they're just not nearly the quality of the old wood. So anyway, it's not my prime topic as a preservationist is still keeping the buildings surviving as they exist as a totality, but I am aware of this interest in dismantling rather than demolition as another aspect of kind of a more efficient society.
I might point out one particular type of lumber that was used in lots of these homes is what was called clear white pine or white pine, and it was a fabulous lumber, and you cannot buy it today. It's just non-existent. It's just not available because those trees were removed from the pineries that we had. It was used for pattern lumber. It was used in many uses because it was very structurally stable lumber. And today, you cannot buy that lumber for any price. It's just not available.
Yeah, and actually, every time I go up to White Pine State Park in Illinois, which is up in the northwestern part of the state, it's one of the few surviving stands of those large, large ranges of clear white pine that were in the Midwest. And basically, you're right, around the early part of the 20th century, these large forests that were in Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota had been used up. A lot of went to Chicago in the rebuilding after the fire, when there was just a huge need for, you know, building materials, and that was the source.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. And I guess it's my understanding, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, that the problem here is that building codes won't let you do this, that they won't let you take, say, bricks from an old house and use that to build another house or take this lumber and put it into
a building. I don't think it's so much the building codes as much as we now have all the products that we buy go through various underwriters' labs and rating systems so that when you buy a new material, you know it's gone through a protocol of certifications. And when you get reused materials, we haven't ramped up a reuse industry that can basically do the same thing. But the inherent knowledge that a lot of us have, particularly like the caller was mentioning, just older, clear wood studs that were this dense wood, there is a way to easily identify their density and therefore their relative quality. So we're working on one. That's one of the issues from the Building Materials Reuse Association is how do we basically get reused materials into some level of certification or protocols or warranties that can help solve some of that marketing problems. Mm.
Do building codes sometimes get in the way of rehab and restoration?
I think that what we've found is that building codes were primarily written with the idea of new construction, and that was largely true up until the 1970s. And starting in 78 and 79, Chicago and Massachusetts actually wrote building rehab codes, and in 2003, the new international existing building code came into existence. So for the first time, we had a model building code written for this distinct purpose of evaluating existing buildings. And that's been a real fundamental shift that represents that in our culture, spending on building rehab is a huge part of the economy and that there was a flaw in the building code because it didn't work well. For example, a lot of the changes in building codes over the years are things about dimensional changes. So if it used to be that a stair tread could only be 9 inches, and then we changed it to 8.5 inches, and then we changed it to 8 inches, the riser on this, you know, every time we changed it, we made it, the existing one no longer legal. But changing every stair in America to gain a fractional interest of an inch in a dimension, as soon as you do that, it changes the width, the breadth, and where it fits in the room. And that's what got to be expensive was a lot of the things that if you were trying to make it all new, it was just sort of impractical. So the new codes are very good at addressing when you grandfather in things and say, yeah, it's already been there. It's been like that for a long time. That you don't have to change. And the safety improvements are focusing on the things that truly we're out and are totally replaced with mechanical systems and electrical and plumbing, which tends to be more of a total replacement rather than repairs. But the major structural components and physical parts of a building are now more easily allowed to retain without having that code trigger that said, oh, you got to make it all new because it's the way the code works.
Yeah. All right, let's talk with someone else. Hoopston is the next caller. This is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Joined the conversation rather late, so forgive me if the topic's already covered. Just to dovetail two quick things on the previous caller, you mentioned about the quality of wood. I suppose you'd only have to probably talk to the Major League Baseball teams with the splintering of the bats. That seems to be a current phenomenon that never happened when I was a kid that I recall. But as far as the wood being no longer available, we recently came back from Key West and went into Harry Truman's summer home, and the person there, the narrator, pointed out that the floors were made of something called California pine that is no longer available, that is completely extinct. So that was kind of interesting to find that out. I did have two quick questions, and I'll listen off air. just was wondering, in my travels in the state, went through Paris, Illinois, and there was a building standing, and the headstone said 1876, and it was still occupied and still being used. And just out of curiosity, I was wondering if your guest knew of the current oldest building in Illinois that's being used, if there's such a thing. We recently took our kids to the Clark House in Chicago, but that's been renovated and moved several times. I think it was originally occupied in 1831 or something. And then as an aside, I was wondering if you had a resource, again, in my travels downstate, if you see a unique old building and you wanted to find out what it was used for originally, is there a resource that we could, you know, send a picture and ask a question? On Route 50 between Flora and Salem, there's a two-story wooden building, dilapidated. It looked like a hotel, but the middle part of the core is cut out. And I was thinking, well, maybe they used that to park wagons or something. Anyway, it was a very unique building, and I was just wondering if there was anybody there in your department that we could contact. And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. A number of interesting questions there. And the first of that is, and this comes up a lot, what's the oldest building? You know, this is kind of the historian side of us all. And that becomes a problematic question, not because we can't identify things that are old, but most of the early buildings that we know about were identified a long time ago and were restored in an era before some of our modern thoughts about this process. So the 1738 Cahokia Courthouse, which is Cahokia in the Metro East area, is certainly one of the oldest buildings we have in our collection of historic buildings in the state. But the building was moved two or three times before it was returned to its more or less original location. And every time they took it apart and moved it, we lost a few parts. So that now when you go there, probably it's 90% a new building, meaning materials from the 1930s rather than materials from the 1730s. So it's certainly an early and old building, but heavily reconstructed. So we have only a handful of 18th century buildings in this state, meaning pre-1800. And they're all in the southern part of the state. And those are our oldest sort of collective structures in the state. And once you get into the early 1800s, we start to get a few more things showing up. But the earliest buildings in our state that survive are from the French colonial influence, because the French got here first. So we have the Powder Magazine at Fort de Chartres, the Cahokia Courthouse, and the Pierre Martin House are three historic properties of that French settlement era, all that date from the mid to late 1700s in the south. Western part of the state. For people who want to know more about where are the historic places in Illinois, our website is a great place to go to, illinoishistory.gov. And within that, you can search the state for historic resources under a program of ours called HAARGIS, H-A-A-R-G-I-S. So it's Historic Architectural and Archaeological Resources, and GIS is a map-based protocol for that. So our HAARGIS system allows people to go to an area, pull up a map of the area, and find dots that will indicate where the historic buildings or older things that have been identified. Buildings that are on the National Register of Historic Places, you can not only find out about them, but the National Register information is available. So if a place as a building or a district has been nominated, there'll be a lot more interesting information about why it was historic, and the nomination papers are all available. So we've got quite a bit of that information available online now at IllinoisHistory.gov.
We'll continue here this morning in this first hour of Focus 580 to talk about historic preservation in Illinois. And we have some callers we'll get right to, and I also would like to reintroduce our guest, Mike Jackson. He's the chief architect of the Preservation Services Division of the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. He's been with the agency since 1983. He was project manager for the restoration of the Dana Thomas House in Springfield and also the David Davis Mansion in Bloomington. He has degrees from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign and Columbia. He's a fellow of the American Institute of Architects. His professional experience includes work in New York City and New Orleans, as well as communities across the state of Illinois. He's a visiting professor of architecture at the U of I Urbana-Champaign. And again, as he mentioned, if you're interested in information about historic structures in Illinois and you want to find out about the Historic Preservation Agency and what they're all about, the easiest thing is to go to their website, which is www.illinoishistory.gov. And we have some other callers here, and we'll get right back to it with someone in St. Charles. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. This is right up my alley. I do a lot of restoration myself. I work for a company. I have my own company, but I work for other guys that do restoration on old Victorian homes, 1880s, 1800s, turn of the century, or whatever. And I also help out with a 1800s farm out here in Garfield Museum, Garfield Farm Museum. It's a working 1800s farm. We have actually salvaged a number of barns and a number of houses and moved them. We saved two farms, which are now museums, and they use it for shows. So up here in the northern part of the state, it's a big push. Although I would admit, Naperville has a big problem with demolishing houses, a number of old Victorian homes in the historic district. Behind North Central College has been wiped out, and you know, million-dollar mansions have been put up in place of it. So there's, I guess, as far as, you know, you're talking about codes and stuff, sometimes I think these cities don't adhere to a lot of it. I think they just, whatever they can get dollar-wise, you know, out of that property, it seems to me they waste of it. I live in Geneva. And Geneva actually is doing a pretty good job of preserving things. If somebody buys that property and wants to build something else on it, they basically would move the house to another piece of land. And it actually has worked out quite a bit. There's a number of houses around the early 1800s out here, which are well kept, by the way.
Interesting that you brought up one of the hot preservation problems today, which is the teardown. And actually, the teardown phenomena was a New York Times editorial today, as this has been seen as something going on across the nation where, you know, again, we have this consumer culture, we're buy the latest, newest thing, and the phenomena of just buying a reasonably viable, you know, decent house and throwing it away and putting a new one there is certainly something the marketplace says is acceptable and certainly promoted. But I think, to me, the big issue is this one of the ecological side. There's the preservation side from culture, and a lot of the buildings that are teardowns are not necessarily old or historic. They may be a 1970s ranch house. But throwing away a building to build, you know, a not much bigger building, sometimes they are bigger, but just the act of throwing it away, like the other guy said, everything now becomes waste. We're not really accumulating a good value system in the way we're throwing things away, and we're teaching people a value system that sometimes I think penny-wise and pound-foolish. We're recycling the little things, you know, the jars and the bottles and cans, and I'm not opposed to recycling, but we're not recycling the big stuff. And most of the demolition waste, somewhere around half of the waste in America is construction and demolition debris from the way in which we're throwing away buildings. So I like to think that the preservation movement is kind of the early warning system of how to think collectively about building reuse rather than the throwaway. And yet the marketplace, I mean, if you look at TV, the extreme home makeover is certainly a popular version of our society, acceptance of that. And I like to say that green makeovers, you know, avoid extremes. So if you're trying to reuse as much of what you've got and be green, you aren't necessarily trying to look extreme. You're trying to kind of use what you've got the best way you can, but not reuse or throw away everything for the sake of this consumerism.
Yeah. Well, certainly the trend that the caller talks about is happening all over. I grew up in a suburb the northwest of Chicago, and it's certainly happened there over the last 10, 15 years. A lot of existing homes were torn down and new homes were built. And I wonder if now, given what's happening in the real estate market, that might slow down a little bit.
Yeah, and again, we're from the preservation standpoint, we're addressing it from a cultural standpoint. We like to think of the historic resources having this special cultural value. Mm-hmm. I think the other one that I'm bringing up is the ecological value, because really we're talking about a disposable building, and should buildings really only be built that last for 30 years and you throw them away after that period and start all over? And that doesn't sound like a very good value in terms of the timeline. And yet the marketplace thinks that's true in terms of the number of people doing that. And it's surprising to me that the facility with which we approach it that way.
Let's talk with someone else. The next caller is in Robinson. This is line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I don't know, Mike, if you're familiar with our Robinson High School gymnasium and auditorium.
Oh, I'm aware of it, and it was a fancy picture on the calendar last year.
Right, it was a 2007, and it's a calendar, and it's on the register, you know, of historic places. And I don't know if I can really talk about it very well because I'm so upset. The school board voted to tear it down. They have hired some company to do it. I asked if they were going to save anything inside of it, and the superintendent said, well, we do have some things we're going to try to save. But it was built, you know, by the WPA in 1938, and Eleanor Roosevelt dedicated it. It's a beautiful gymnasium. The voters voted against a new gymnasium and high school, but the school board built one anyway. And so they don't even know what they're going to use with this space. Obviously, with a town of 6,000 people, you don't need the space for something like you would be in a city, because there's nothing around it, really. They have voted to tear it down. I just don't know what to do except stand out there, and if they've got a wrecking ball, stand in front of it. But that probably wouldn't help much, except I'd lose my life.
Well, I think this early on in the discussion today, one of the aspects that was brought up was this issue with which, you know, the ease with which we throw buildings away just because they're old. And I would have to say it's my observation across the state that within the school management, the school system, we probably have the highest prejudice against old buildings of any collective group. And we actually have rules in the state of Illinois for evaluating schools that are age-based. That, you know, the rules for schools say if it's functionally equal to 100 years old, then you're supposed to get rid of it. I don't know what that means, you know. Functionally equivalent of a 100-year-old structural beam, you know, a beam holds up a thing. It has no age limit, or a space has no age limit. And the fact that we've embedded within the value system of school performance and age criteria strikes me as ridiculous. And that's one of the topics we're addressing in our kind of what reforms need to happen in state policy. We also have a state policy that encourages schools to be built out in the middle of nowhere in, you know, the cornfield at the edge of town, you know, where it's going to cost lots more gas to get there forever than rebuilding in the, you know, the neighborhood area or the older area of the city where more people can walk to school. So we've got a bunch of public policies that are problems because they don't encourage thoughtful reinvestment and they encourage sprawl. And the school system's logic is probably the worst in our state in terms of not advocating for any preservation-based or asset management that really looks at what we've got.
And
you're at the crosshairs of that. And Robinson, you've already gone through it. And, you know, we try to be not at the end of the process. We like to be thinking ahead to how can we collectively influence a decision and not get to this standing in front of the wrecking ball.
Well, I just moved here 3 years ago. I grew up here, but then I hadn't been back since really 1959, 56 when I moved away. And when I came back, this whole thing had been going on a long time. You're exactly right. But there's another building built by the same people, but it's older. It's our part of the Lincoln Elementary School, and it built by the same people, and they have kept it up, you know, and they're using it. The gym looks just like it did when I was there in the 40s. But how do you get the money? I mean, if I had money, I suppose I'd buy it, but how do you get the money, you know?
Well, I think, the real issue is not – after the fact, when somebody said, I don't want this anymore, and it's on their land, that's too late to kind of get involved. We want to be more involved. I'm concerned about the attitude that is all the old schools have to be gotten rid of because only new schools will work. Well, if you've been to Cambridge or Oxford and Harvard, they seem to have pretty good education programs, and they're pretty old buildings. And again, this, I think, speaks to a bias in our culture. And I also think it's a convenience factor for schools because they function 9 months of a year. There's an attitude that it's just easier to basically throw the building away and build a new one. And then when you get the new one built, then you abandon what you've got. The Leal School in Urbana is a wonderful case study of a preserved WPA school, well thought of by the neighborhood, reinvested in by the school district. And very innovatively, during the period the school was being renovated, they actually built a temporary school in an old, I think it was a Kmart or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so they made a temporary school in a former Kmart to use so they could renovate the building without the students in it. And that's a great case study of success. And then it came from community and other citizen input, but it's a great building, well-made, WPA, and it's got that attraction to it. So it's unfortunate that Robinson didn't have that kind of key political leadership in the school board to see that.
That's exactly right. Because most of the people here that I've talked to, and they did a statistical study which said 61% of the people in this area wanted to save it. But people voted against the new high school, but it didn't matter. They did what they wanted. And they're doing what they want here. But I can't get the people to fight them, you know. But you're right. It's too late, I guess. Thank you very, very much.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We'll try to get one more caller here in the time that's left, and this is someone who is in Champaign and on line number two. Hello.
Yeah, actually 2 points. One is in terms of I taught up in Chicago, and I had somebody that worked for Sears at one point and did a little project on Sears mail order houses. So I guess in the Joliet area, some of these areas, there were quite a few these houses built. Do you know anything about that? Or?
Yep, and actually, I have right here in front of me a brochure called Discover Greenville Sears Kit Houses from Greenville, Illinois, which is sort of in the metro St. Louis area. The Sears homes, there were thousands of them. They were actually made and assembled at the Sears plant in Cairo, Illinois, and then shipped around across the country. And they marketed them from, you know, around the early part of the 20th century up through the 1930s. And it becomes, because I think we like this brand identification, it's become now a way to attach yourself to the history of something in your neighborhood, your community, the Sears name. It's got cachet. And so we're seeing preservation organizations in various towns use this as another part of their survey and identifying what's noteworthy in their town. Carlinville, Illinois, which is a little town in the southwestern part of the state, or central western, has a collection of about 200 Sears houses, all built by the Standard Coal Company when they expanded, and they built a whole subdivision of them. And we've got authors in Illinois who've written about them. So it's kind of the fun part of all of this is discovery and finding these things. And we have some of the records from the Sears company about where they sold them, but we've never found the critical list where it said, here's the addresses of where all the Sears houses went to. So it's a little more of a searching mechanism to find them out. Several websites up there for that, and the Sears company website even talks about that.
And then finally, what I find pretty aggravating is this big box type store, and I think it was Walmart, certainly one of them, that, you know, the building, what, 20 years, the way they're put up and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I'm looking for a reaction from you.
Well, one of our reactions to the proliferation of big box stores has been the Illinois Main Street program, which is a program, you know, to aim to help smaller downtown areas compete as both centers of community and retail. And now, at this point, Champaign is one of our new Main Street towns. It's working its way up through the process. Last week, I was in Hoopston, had a caller from Hoopston earlier, and they're just getting started on their Main Street program. Danville's got one in terms of regional. There's about 70 of them around the state. So we're not going to replace the big box stores in terms of some of the retail scale that they offer, but we're certainly promoting an alternative retail environment that's quite popular and also has that kind of smart growth, walkable, tight location where we put all these things together that make great places.
We are just about the point we have to finish. We have maybe about a minute or two. One of the things that agencies like yours and people who are concerned with preservation do periodically is they compile lists of notable buildings that they think are endangered. There certainly is a list of endangered structures here in the state of Illinois. Anything you might want to pick on that list to mention?
Well, just that's done by Landmarks Illinois, which is the statewide advocacy organization. So the preservation community is kind of divided between public policy organizations like ours, the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency, advocacy organizations, Landmarks Illinois, and the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and they both have an endangered places list. And then at local community levels, local organizations and public preservation commissions, Urbana and Champaign both have them. So it's a fairly wide collective network of people that are interested in this topic. And at the core is probably still homeowners. Historic homeowners are probably one of the strongest groups. The future of all this, I think there's a really great interest in the recent past. You know, the next level of what's going to be historic. So things like the Assembly Hall in Champaign, which are a very striking modernist structure from the 60s, are now starting to get to that critical point of being near 50 years old, which is our age limit for historic recognition. And so that's part of where the future of preservation is at, is that next generation of buildings.
Do you, and this maybe not enough time for this question, but I think some people are concerned about or but might hesitate to seek historic status for a building because it might place some limits on what they can do with it. What are the pros and cons of that?
Well, the National Register of Historic Places, which is the program we operate, is a planning tool that identifies historic places collectively. It's a nationwide list. It does not place any direct restrictions on property owners, but it does make them eligible for various benefits. So that, as a public tool, addresses that policy by saying that we're going to use the federal and the state program as an identification tool, not a restriction tool. Where it's linked to restrictions is at the local level. So the power to designate something and say, therefore, you have to follow a preservation process in dealing with it is embedded with communities. So a city has to pass an ordinance, and that's when we regulate it, just as we would zoning and the other building regulatory roles that go in place. So that power exists at the community level.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We have been talking with Mike Jackson. He's the chief architect of the Preservation Services Division of the Illinois Historic Preservation Agency. And if you'd like to find out more about the agency and about this issue, you can look at their website, which is www.illinoishistory.gov. Mr. Jackson, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.